On behalf of the Harvard Law School Forum, the Harvard AIDS Institute, and the AIDS Practice Group of the Harvard Legal Aid Bureau, I would like to welcome you in attendance at what promises to be a very informative and provocative exchange during these next couple of hours. The Harvard Law School Forum has worked consistently to bring leading speakers from diverse backgrounds to the law school, where they have addressed the crucial topics of their time. We continue that tradition today with our esteemed panel centering on the shifting demographics of the contemporary population affected by AIDS. In particular, they will focus on a disease that is now spreading most rapidly among people of color, and specifically women of color. Our panel will be moderated by Ms. Jean McGuire of Brandeis University and formerly of the AIDS Action Council in Washington, D.C., and she will be introducing the panelists. But first, we will have a few brief introductory remarks from Andy Ward of the Harvard Legal Aid Bureau and Dr. Richard Marlink of the Harvard AIDS Institute. For any of you who are interested in gaining the panelists' insight on specific aspects related to today's topic, we've reserved some time at the end of the second hour to field questions from the audience. So if you could please hold them until then, that'd be appreciated. We are confident that you will find this afternoon rewarding, and we extend our great thanks to the panelists for sharing their time and their knowledge with other interested parties. Andy?
I just want to make a couple of quick comments before we get started. The first thing is that when the idea of inviting a speaker was bantered around in the AIDS practice group meeting a few months ago, we had no idea that we were eventually going to put together such an esteemed and distinguished panel of people to come here today. So I'd like to thank the AIDS Institute and the forum for making this possible. The second thing is to just explain how our interest developed in these policy issues. And as people may or may not know, the Legal Aid Bureau is a full-range legal services office, and we represent indigent clients in Middlesex and Suffolk counties on a broad range of legal issues. And a lot of our clients are HIV positive or have AIDS, and which is why we started the AIDS Practice Group. And our own experience was that we had clients that faced obstacles. I mean, it really was born out of our frustration of seeing clients eventually face obstacles about which we could do very little. And a classic example that comes to mind is in an area such as housing, where we as lawyers can keep someone in their apartment for extended periods of time when we're defending them in an eviction action. In fact, we're hated by landlords all across Middlesex and Suffolk counties because we're so good at keeping people in their apartments. But eventually there comes the day when a landlord can get someone out of their apartment and they can make sure the person goes. And at that point, a number of our clients had problems finding housing because either they were substance abusers or because they were on methadone treatment or because housing authorities just didn't have any more room. And you know, knowing that your client is leaving your office after you successfully defended them and that your client will have nowhere to go is a really intense frustration. And it's out of these kinds of experiences that our interest in addressing some of the larger policy issues developed. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much for coming. Thank the panelists and Dr. Marlink.
Thanks, Andy. I'd also hope that this becomes perhaps a regular affair where we can collaborate with the law school in bringing forums centered around AIDS in a joint way here or other places on campus. We've done that with many of the other graduate schools, so I hope we're starting something with the law school. Jean McGuire, who is our moderator today, has worked in the disability arena for the last 20 years. At the national level, she was Assistant Director of Governmental Affairs for the Association for Citizens with Mental Retardation before taking over as Executive Director of the AIDS Action Council. She's currently working on her dissertation at Brandeis University's Heller School, and her research focuses on ethical issues associated with the implication of HIV research access policies. I think the other compliment we can pay Jean McGuire is when I talked to several of the panel members trying to talk about putting the panel together, or when Julie Ryu did, when we said, well, Gene McGuire is going to moderate, they all said, okay, we'll be there. So Gene, take over.
I think Rick may be overstating that. I'm pleased to be here today with this distinguished panel, who, among whom I also count friends, over a period of struggles in the epidemic. I want to begin our session with the words of a woman living with HIV disease in San Francisco, because it is with and for her and others that we undertake these discussions. Moni Harrington writes in the book Positive Women, "I am, we are, they are, you are not it, a veteran in America with the AIDS of America, crossing life war, combating a disease infiltrated with the aid of America. By society's lack of responsibilities, mistold legends will die when a hungry child cries with the AIDS of America. Those spared will cry too because their mothers have died from a disease with the aid of America. To make your living at night under the red light, girl, you will be charged with the AIDS of America. To be raped before and receive a disease to cry out under the black night, as an act of your pain will be relegated, shame on your name when they hear you got the AIDS of America. To be disregarded, disassociated, to lay in a bed for a father to spit upon a beautiful face and race to the mirror, because you are a black woman in America, a lesbian's choice you are not to have a face or voice. Stop denying, lesbians do die with the AIDS of America. The crumbs of racism will fall off into your child's poor wet eyes and bleed with the aid of America. Little children will suffer from a never-to-be-gotten disease with the AIDS of America. I recommend this book, which is The Voices of Positive Women from All Over the World, for people to read more of Imani and others. Last year, over 103,000 cases of AIDS were reported in the United States, almost a third of the cumulative 350,000 cases so far. This number is partially an artifact of the changes that happened in the case definition during last year. However, even without those changes, we would have identified over 100,000 new cases in the last 2 years, as many as it took us 10 years to accumulate before. Among the most alarming aspects of the new statistics is the fact that the highest proportionate increases were among blacks and Hispanics and women and youth. Of those between 13 and 24 who were the fastest growing age groups, women constituted over 30% versus the overall 16% of cases they constitute in all of the other age groups. Moreover, of these younger women, over 25% reported heterosexual transmission as their risk factor, compared to only 9% reporting heterosexual transmission overall. Not to be forgotten when we sum the statistics and the toll of this disease, gay and bisexual men, including those who also report intravenous drug use, still account for 50% of the cases being reported annually. We gather today at a challenging juncture in the epidemic. 10 years ago this week, Margaret Heckler simultaneously announced the discovery of the etiologic virus, human immunodeficiency virus, and predicted the creation of a successful vaccine within 2 years. Last week, the deliberations of the AIDS Vaccine Advisory Group in Washington, D.C., more than confirmed that 5 years from now would be an extremely optimistic projection. This discrepancy between what was hoped for and what has come to pass is not simply a function of the foolish musings of a former Secretary of Health. The rapid acquisition of new knowledge that characterized the early stages of the epidemic in this country lulled many of us into believing we were on our way to reconstructing AIDS into a manageable, chronic, if still infectious, disease. I tell this story in part because I want to suggest that an assessment of the changing dynamics of the epidemic only in terms of numbers, or in terms of the gender, race, and sexual preference divides commonly cited, is insufficient. These lines, which have a habit of shifting, provide far too narrow arenas within which to assess the public policy responses to the epidemic. Missing or obscured can be effects of class and race as they intersect, class and sex as they intersect, lack of infrastructure in communities, historic individual and collective experiences of oppression, the relative meanings of continued uncertainty about the pathogenesis and appropriate treatment of this disease. As we consider the challenges of the epidemic, poet Imani Harrington challenges us to see all of her as she is, an educated African-American lesbian poet and performance artist who used to use drugs. and now wants to live. Our challenge in this second decade is not to give in to glib dichotomizing of the difficult issues embedded in facing the epidemic, but to evolve and apply, as Mindy and her husband Bob have begun in the prevention arena, an ecological understanding of this disease, in prevention, but also in care, in treatment, and even in research. I'm very pleased to begin our panel discussion today by introducing a friend and a colleague in the Pew Foundation's doctoral efforts and about to receive her doctorate, Christine Gebbe, who is currently leading the nation's fight and I think brings to us a perspective that's brought not only from her very recent efforts in Washington, but from years of working first with the original commission and secondly in her significant work in the states and ultimately in her work in other junctures of the federal government, including the Centers for Disease Control. Christine?
Thank you very much, and it is a pleasure to be here this afternoon, and always a pleasure to have a reason to stop and reflect on what it is we are all doing, how it is changing over time. I don't know what your experiences are in going about your daily life, but often we get very much caught up with just doing what we need to do and stepping back to think of how a context has shifted or a process has changed over time can lead to new insight into what has been done or what might need to be done. Let me start off then by sharing with you some perspectives I have developed on what are these changing dynamics of the epidemic, something about how that makes the policy context different, and some other issues that have made the policy context different, and then finally, how those shifts are experienced in what is happening in the country right now. Bearing in mind that these are, in all cases, from my perspective, and in that regard, as for all of us, limited by what opportunities we've had for dialogue. And that's another reason for being glad to be here, because there's a chance to hear responses to them and to push further at the issues they raise or to see them in yet a different context. You've already heard some of the changing dynamics of the epidemic, but I want to particularly reflect with you on three things: the issues of cases in women, the deeper incursions into communities of color, and the wider age range that we need to consider. The new cases in women. In the eyes of many across this country, and I do get out and talk with a lot of communities around this country, this disease is, for them, a disease of gay white men. That's really all that has sunk into their heads. And while it is certainly true that a large percentage of cases in this country are gay white men, and if you include communities of color, are gay men, globally, this is an equal opportunity virus affecting men and women. And increasingly, as the statistics of this past year show in the addition of new cases, a disease of women, with some of our fastest growing rates of the disease in women. Understanding it as a disease that can affect both genders is an important part of helping communities see that they need to deal with it much more broadly than they have. Along that line, what I find for many people, and it's unfortunately, I think, reinforced by some of the way we report statistics, people hear descriptions from the epidemiologic literature or other places and hear this as a disease of gay men, women, communities of color, hemophiliacs, children, and they hear substance abusers, and they hear each of those groups described as if they were each a little pod of people somehow not interacting with any others. So that the notion that there is a gay community and a community of color, as if they were two separate things and not that there are some gay men of color, or that there are women and substance abusers as if they are not intersecting when there are women who abuse substances, is an important mythology that we have to break down. And the changing dynamic with the increasing cases in women has helped break down some of that phenomenon. A related piece is the increasing number of children involved. And here I include not just the growing number of infected children, those infected by their mothers at the time of birth, but the growing number of children affected because they are living in families with this disease, even if they themselves are not infected. And that is reflected in the growing discussion of what are labeled as AIDS orphans, children who, while still of an an age too young to be independent are left without a biologic parent by this disease, again, whether or not they are infected. And that is very much tied up with the women's issue, because in our society, and particularly in some of the socioeconomic groups affected severely by this epidemic, women are the dominant caregivers, and women being infected leads to more problems with children as far as long-term care for those children. Similarly, deeper incursions into communities of color. This epidemic remains disproportionately affecting all ethnic communities in this country. It has meant a whole new challenge in translating materials, and I don't just mean literally translating brochures, but thinking through materials and developing programs that will be responsive to the needs of those various communities. And where the community involved has not been comfortable confronting the epidemic, has not been a part of the process so far, just finding the leadership contact points in various communities has been a process that's had to be engaged in across the country. And that issue reinforces over and over again how much this becomes a localized problem. You can make a national statistic that says X number of people involved with the epidemic are Hispanic, but it takes a good deal of very local looking to realize how many different Hispanic Latino communities there are across the United States, each of which has a different approach to what they want to communicate, how they want to communicate it, what images and languages work. I think we're going to hear more about that a little later. And then finally, the issue of a wider age range. Many people think of this as a disease of young adults and newborn infants, with an occasional acknowledgement that there is some blurring elsewhere. But the images that a lot of people have gotten from the television, from the stories that have sunk in their heads, are of the very sick newborns, often the abandoned newborns, and then of the young adults, without realizing that we have a whole age range of youth that includes some of those children infected as newborns who are now getting up to be preteens, and some of them even teens, that we have many people in their teen years, unfortunately, who are infected as teens and living through those years, and we have a fair number of adults who are living up beyond young adulthood into middle age and even older age, some of whom were infected at various points along the way. And as I talk to people who do HIV-related services, in many towns there are individuals seeking services for their HIV infection who are up in their 60s, 70s, and even 80s. We have a society that doesn't comfortably acknowledge that people over 50 have sex lives. I'm not sure how we've dealt with our segmentation of that notion. As we are planning the White House Conference on Aging for next year, we're trying to figure out how to plan a thread around HIV infection that can pick up the issues of the older adult now having to give child care for an orphan child, the adult caregivers of individuals living with HIV, many of whom are older adults, parents caring for adult children, and then the older adult living with HIV or trying to avoid HIV in his or her own life, and what we're going to do for that communication. So all of those are parts of the changing dynamic that we need to think about. Then the issue of different policy contexts. And I identify three things that are really affecting where we're going with policy. The first is directly a result of the first things I mentioned, and that is new community groups not just asking, but demanding to be participants in the process. Groups that have not been at the HIV policy table acknowledging that this is a problem for their community and wanting to be there. That means in some communities bigger tables, different shaped tables, tables where people have to learn new language, a different context of where we're going with that. Second area, new and different expectations of involvement. I think this epidemic has, over its decade-plus course, set a new standard on the involvement of the infected and those immediately affected at the decision-making table. While we have, I've been in healthcare practice 30 years, we have had a long time of some form of lip service of consult the patient. And had a token surviving patient of X on the panel to talk about something, or invited survivors to be a part of boards, and groups like the American Cancer Society frequently do include people who have lived through cancer as a part of their active decision-making group. I don't know when we've had a disease like HIV in which those directly infected have been as forceful and as clear about their need to be at any decision-making table where their lives would be affected. Now, part of that comes from the early history of this disease, where people felt like if they weren't there, nothing was going to happen anyway. and may well have been a very legitimate viewpoint. But some of it is just this notion of you cannot treat me as an object. I am not a victim. I will not be ignored. I must be there and be a partner. And that's a different dynamic for a lot of people in policy and decision-making positions to accept. And then finally, the more immediate different policy context that I'm a part of living through and that I don't think we understand well yet at all is that unlike the first 12 years of the epidemic, when the nation's political structure tried to pretend this disease was not real, we now have an HIV-friendly administration, one that has committed a huge increase in funds, that has created the job I fill, that is reshaping what it is doing about the epidemic. Whether you are pleased or not pleased with the way we have done all of that from this administration, it is a different thing that we have to deal with. The policy dynamic of the early years was generally that people out in the community, and here I'll speak from my role at that time as a state health director, if we wanted to get things done, had to band up together, figure out what we wanted, batter the federal government as far as we could, but at some point ultimately go to Congress to get some action because policy decisions stopped at a certain point, came to a screeching halt, and you couldn't even have a conversation with people higher up. Or we had the work of two different commissions that pointed out some of what were very easy things to do that just got filed on a shelf and nothing happened. And now we have an administration in which there are HIV knowledgeable people at multiple levels in many departments. It's not just that my position exists. It is that the Assistant General Counsel at HHS is Nan Hunter, who wrote some of the best early stuff about how the law affects this epidemic. Or Phil Lee as the Assistant Secretary of Health, who chaired the San Francisco Board of Health through many years of this epidemic. An Assistant Director at Housing and Urban Development, who is the former mayor of San Francisco, who lived through this epidemic in the community. The new Assistant Director of Health at the Department of Defense, who is a former Commissioner of Health for the City of New York. From the early years of the epidemic. Wherever you look in the federal system, there are now people at very high levels for whom this is not an uncomfortable topic and not a problem. But the community doesn't quite know how to deal with that yet, and we don't quite know how to take that out to the community. Just a few comments then on how all of these shifts are experienced in four areas. One, in research. My example there of the shift is the new Drug Development Task Force, on which Mindy Fullilove sits, which has just had its first meeting. A new group created to try and answer some of the perplexing dilemmas in our development of HIV-related drugs, of what are the roadblocks? Why is it taking so long? Why haven't we got new drugs appearing? What's the holdup? And instead of making that just a scientific question and answering the Institute of Medicine to convene some wise and white-haired, gray-bearded scientists to talk about it, or making it just a money question and going and finding some people who write checks, or any other single thing, the Department of Health and Human Services has created a task force on which sit some of the most distinguished academic scientists working on this subject, but also some of the very distinguished leaders from the pharmaceutical and biotech industry who are investing private resources in this issue, the regulators and the federal government leaders themselves, but also activists and advocates from the HIV community, including people living with the virus, all seated as equal members around a table, asked to collectively solve this problem of why aren't drugs being developed more rapidly. That has not existed before. Around other scientific dilemmas, around other regulatory dilemmas, and I think marks the shift that we're looking at. In the services area, the change I note is the change that's happening across the nation in the community service organizations. One of the changes is the development of new ones. So in a community that may have had two or three major HIV service organizations in the past, there are now a half a dozen or 10, each one of which is serving a specific ethnic community, a specific neighborhood, a gender group, a sexual orientation group. But even more dramatic are the shifts in some of the larger HIV service organizations, which have their roots early in the epidemic and often have their founding in a service organization that was rooted in giving clinical services or advocacy services to the gay community or the gay and lesbian community. And many of those organizations have now shifted, so their boards are very diverse, including both genders, all sexual orientations, several ethnicities, and their staff has shifted. And if you look at their service load, it has shifted to include a much more diverse mix of people as they have tried to respond to a community need for service. That has caused tensions in the community as people wonder whether their old organization has abandoned them or people wonder whether the shifts in this organization are genuine. But it has really moved the dialogue in some communities as people try to integrate that shift. In prevention, the dramatic piece I notice is the new community-based prevention planning process that CDC has inaugurated this year. In the past, planning for federally funded prevention was basically done nationally at the Centers for Disease Control. They divided up the money into pots, gave it to the states with very rigid guidelines on what you had to spend it on. A dominant amount of the spending was on counseling and testing. External review of those programs over the last year illustrated that this wasn't the most effective way, and CDC got very clear messages that having it planned centrally was contrary to their own best theories about having a community own its own prevention activities. And so the prevention planning has now been turned to the states in a process which gives them a year to develop how they would spend their share of the federal prevention money in their community. That was done with some trepidation, because many communities at the grassroots level think state government is a bunch of crooks, not people you can trust. They never involve anybody. You never know what they're going to do. The money never gets to us locally. But certainly 50 plans, planned flexibly, is more like what the neighborhoods would want than having one national plan. And the guidelines that have gone out have been much more explicit than previous plans regarding who has to be at the table, how it has to reflect the whole epidemic, what has to go on. This is an experiment in the making. And we still don't know how it will play out, but again, an evidence of the changing dynamic. And then finally, as I sit down, because I've been given the hook here, the last thing I did want to mention is what I think is the other dynamic around the creation of my job as a national policy person rather than a federal policy person. My job is not just to do policy for the multiple agencies of the federal government and how we spend federal money, although that is an important part of what I do. It is to see that we have a national policy that can engage the whole country. And what I found is we have almost no models for that. We're used to writing plans for federal agencies or plans for specific activities, but a real national agenda that could weave the whole country together isn't something we've done well, and we're figuring it out as we go and stumbling along the way. And that is probably going to be one of my most difficult challenges as I go forward with this job, is how to stay sensitive to all those groups that are now alerted to the issue, want to be a part, but also to draw in the rest of the folks that haven't figured it out yet and make it something of a whole that really can work. Thank you very much.
The real reason they invited me is that I'm a control queen when it comes to time. And I want to assure you, you're not going to have to wait till the end of the second hour to ask your questions. I'm delighted to introduce a new friend and colleague for me in the course of my work here in the state of Massachusetts over the last couple of years, and that is Dr. Nicholas Parkhurst-Carbajera. Almost, Nicholas. I've been working on it. But I want to say something that isn't in the program for Nicholas, because my experience of him in the gatherings in this state, in terms of, in part, determining the direction to go with the prevention planning process that Christine just alluded to, as well as other difficult discussions about what we are doing in the arena of gay men as we look at the new dynamics in terms of other communities and allocation of resources, et cetera, is that he is really, first and foremost, an advocate for the communities that he works with, for the communities that he's a part of, and for people generally living with this disease. And I appreciate the tenacity with which he brings his concerns to different tables. It's always an interesting moment to having an opportunity to facilitate Nicholas, but also the perspective that he has that is intimately rooted in the experience of his people, his many different people. So, Nicholas.
Thank you.
Yes,
I think I'm going to stay here, if that's okay. Buenas tardes, good afternoon. It's going to be difficult to keep time here. It's not a question of where to start. That's easy. The question is where to stop. There's so
when
many
I
issues.
Say time.
There's so many issues to address. One of the things that strikes me and many in the Latino community about the approach to AIDS in the United States is that it is so individualistic, so much based on personal behaviors. I'm going to read a short quote from a Latino with AIDS that participated in one of the many focus groups that we run around the state. And this person said, "We need family services. We are different from most Americans who are more individualistic. When something happens to us, we involve our brothers, our sisters, our grandmothers, our grandfathers, and everybody else." It is really surprising to find that the entire edifice of AIDS prevention, AIDS services, and AIDS research is individually focused. In fact, I was struck also in Ms. Gebe's presentation just now, even the ordering of the priorities strikes me as particularly revealing about the mind frame that we all have adopted towards AIDS. And we talked about four initiatives. You talked about four initiatives: research, services, prevention, and national policy. And we're going always from a focus on tertiary individual interventions, medical interventions, service interventions for specific individuals, prevention, which is basically focus on individual behavior modification. And these are all what we call in public health downstream approaches. We need, and I hope that that's something that the national policy, the national agenda will focus on, we need upstream approaches. We need systemic interventions that will effectively control the spread of this epidemic. We don't need to continue doing so much research to find out that one of the strongest links to HIV infection in the United States is substance abuse. But at the same time that we pay lip service to this, in every single state around the country, the budgets for substance abuse services are being slashed. If this is coordinated policy, I am at a loss for words to express it or understand it. Let me talk about a few individual instances. I think that much of the talk about the changing face of the AIDS epidemic is really more a question of the changing face of the researchers in the AIDS epidemic. When you're looking for something in a particular community, that's the only place where you will find it. I am reminded of a friend of mine who died in 1982 of what we would call today AIDS. At that point, I still think we were calling it GRIDS. And this friend of mine, a Puerto Rican, had these brown lesions all over his skin. And three prominent dermatologists in New York refused to make a diagnosis of KS, because all the pictures of KS they had ever seen in all the books were purple. Of course, if you are dark brown to start with, it's very difficult to develop purple lesions. But this is symbolic of what has happened in this epidemic. It's not so much that there's a growing number of Latinos and African Americans and people of other nationalities being affected by the epidemic, but that we have started to look at people who present the symptoms and not disregard them as being just drug users or people with weird diseases. We also have some issues here that I think are very important to focus on. We are constantly looking at additional institutional mechanisms to communicate the needs, the opinions, the ideas of all the communities affected by AIDS. And first, I think there's a need to guarantee adequate access, representation, and sufficient supports for effective participation in those mechanisms that already exist. It is very easy, once a particular community has struggled to gain a measure of control over sources of financing and sources of care, for those communities to share what they have fought so hard for. And we find that more and more the policies under which we are forced to live establish a false antagonism between different groups of people affected by the AIDS epidemic. So sometimes we want to present this as an antagonism between the gay community and the Latino community, the African American community, and the Native American community, when the real issue here is one of observing what is the systemic response and the systemic availability of services for people with AIDS and people with other conditions, and to go from there to create a policy that unites us instead of separates us and makes us literally fight each other over funding. We have always sustained that it is more important to know what patient has a disease than what disease a patient has. Population-based services is not only the wave of the future, is the only way to provide realistic services. And for this to happen, we need to abandon the old ideas that a service is better when it is provided by people who have been delivering it for a long time. In fact, the experience of the gay organizations in the AIDS epidemic proves to us that cultural competence is a fundamental piece of any service. Gay men were forced to develop their own organizations because the existing system was unable and incompetent, and in many occasions unwilling, to provide the services that the community needed. In the same way, many other nationalities, and you will not hear me using the word minorities, I think it's a very offensive word, many different nationalities in this country have been forced to create their own services also. And that is as it should be. We have to be aware, however, that the cost of serving individuals with AIDS and the infrastructural supports necessary to conduct those services are not the same across communities. And we have to start factoring those things in at the policy level. One of the things that I would like to address very briefly is that we have policies in place, regulations, formulas for allocating funds that have no bearing on reality. As we sit here today, we are attempting to fast track the reauthorization of the Ryan White Care Act bill in Congress. Now, the formula that allocates funding under the Ryan White Care Act bill, which provides emergency AIDS funding for cities disproportionately affected by AIDS, is such that a person with AIDS, and this is going to sound horrible, and it is, a person with AIDS in New York and San Francisco is worth three times what a person with AIDS is worth in Boston, and eight to nine times what a person with AIDS in Ponce, Puerto Rico is worth. We are using cumulative data to determine the needs of people who are alive today. And that is not only bad statistics, that is bad policy. We need to change that. We need to make sure that cultural competence is not defined merely by who sits on what board, but by the consumer interpretation of whether those services are appropriate or not appropriate. We need to establish national policies on what constitutes fairness in funding. We need to make sure that the policies across the United States are not imposing one cultural solution to the problems of diverse nationalities. I will focus on one particular item. It has been mentioned here before that the AIDS epidemic has brought upon us also the issue of people of different age groups caring for young orphans. Particularly in the Latino community, this translates to grandparents, usually grandmothers, taking care of their children. But we have policies in place that favor the European-American solution to orphans is to place them in a permanent home, and the preferred permanent solution is adoption. It is contrary to the principles and cultural values of many cultures, not only the Latino culture, to force grandparents to adopt their own grandchildren. But many times, and this is policy today in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, if a grandparent refuses to adopt a grandchild, the grandchild will be given to somebody else that will adopt them. So the kinship relationships are not respected. And this is something that should be changed at the policy level. There are other policy issues that I would like to address. For example, we have a major problem along the Northeast, and that is that Congress arbitrarily establishes a cap on Medicaid funding for the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, which has one of the highest incidences of HIV infection and AIDS in the world. And the Medicaid cap, the artificial Medicaid cap, is such that it's approximately 70-some million dollars every year to serve 2.5 medically indigent persons in the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. It does not take high math to understand that 2.5 into 80 million doesn't go much farther than a box of aspirin and a couple of pieces of gauze. And this is supposed to do for the care of 2.5 million people. Until and unless we address that issue, the Northeastern Latino communities will be burdened by what is known as the air bridge, the necessity of people to come to other parts of the Northeast to receive services that we should all be entitled to. By the way, this is not a charity. We're talking about Puerto Ricans pay fully all taxes into Social Security and Medicaid. So this arbitrary cap is, even in my point of view, unconstitutional, such as the request to shut up.
I don't think it rises to that level, Nicholas.
I want to end by saying that one last thing that I hope somebody asks for is that you mentioned also the high importance of peers in this epidemic, and we think that it is of vital importance. But we think that, again, we need to be very careful not to interpret peership from a strictly cultural perspective. In the field of AIDS, this has come down to some people of a particular culture, European Americans in general, defining peers strictly on a technological laboratory model. In fact, people who are HIV infected are considered peers. People who are not HIV infected are not. This does not necessarily translate well into other communities where peership is defined more on a cultural, familial, or community way. And I'll stop here. Thank you.
I take back that stuff I said about all the time you'll have for questions, because I've written down so many of my own, and I'll exert the prerogative of chair at least for some of them. I'm pleased to introduce next Roger McFarlane. If for no other reason, I'm happy that this circumstance came about, because it's been a long time since we've seen each other. Roger has a long, long history in this disease and has on a number of occasions very frankly framed the issues as he sees it, as I fully expect him to do today. Roger.
Thanks, Jean. Thanks. This is an awfully nice group of people to be to come up here and fight with this weekend. I'm going to speak just very briefly on the role of not-for-profits, that is specifically community-based organizations and philanthropic foundations, because in the absence of adequate leadership from elected and appointed officials historically, or the inadequacy of the response from our traditional medical institutions and research machines, that much of the policy making that we have today, and in fact many of the problems we have too, how the epidemic is framed, is as a result of influence by the growth of the community groups and the mobilization of the philanthropic world far before most government agencies. There's a number of advantages to that in that many true innovations have occurred as a result of the development of the community-based organizations and the reactions of organized philanthropy. On the other hand, we also get distracted criticizing those responses sometimes because what is at the root of all this is the failure of a much larger system to respond meaningfully to this plague. And Christina and I will talk about this a lot. I have a lot of respect for Christina, and we work very well together, but I'm also a little cynical about the national policymaking function, because I think what lies at the root, what the true barriers to developing these programs has been how we as a culture value the people this disease happens to. That it's not about, we know what science needs to be done. We've had three presidential commissions, three Office of Technology Assessment reports, an FDAR report. We'll have another task force. We've had 200 congressional hearings. I've had three Surgeon General reports. We know the model services. We know the communities in need. We know how to direct preventive education in targeted populations. But what underlies all this is our unwillingness to do that, to unleash the sort of resources we would unleash in the Persian Gulf, for example, or that sort of political will and financial latitude to solve a problem. And I'm convinced it's because of who it happens to. Back to the private groups. A few things they have done, and we're going to continue to depend on them for. Provision of direct services, that is, in the development of new models and standards of practice, frankly. The whole beef about pre- and post-test counseling, the population-based or community-based direct services, services provided by peers. The self-empowerment movement of people with AIDS is extraordinary compared to any disease category. That's an important safety net that a lot of people continue to depend on, but is grossly inadequate for the scope of the problem we face. The very best prevention programs have come out of those community-based groups. That is because they're targeted, they're explicit, they're culturally sensitive, they are sanctioned and reinforced on a number of social and cultural and informational levels, something that I would say our school systems, the Centers for Disease Control, has routinely, for political reasons, refused to do or refused to fund. Mass market public awareness and press relations. When I started doing this work in 1980, before it had a name, my friends were laying in shit and being set afire in beds at Sloan Kettering, at NYU, at Cornell, at Columbia, our finest institutions where we were trained, that any amount of compassion that's been generated has not been an accident, and frankly, it's been a boon to the gay community. We've worked very, very hard, from things as silly as our red ribbons on the award show to major confrontations with, you know, newspaper editors, to have this dialectic shape compassionately. We've also, and Gene McGuire can talk a lot more about this than I can, most of the policy changes we have seen have come as a direct result of lobbying by community-based organizations and foundations. That is, initial appropriations for Ryan White, the Americans with Disabilities Act, acceleration of the FDA's investigational new drugs approvals. All of those, anything we've achieved in this came from those CBOs funding lobby groups to do it, not that fool Peggy Heckler getting up and saying they're going to do something. They sent her to Ireland. We've achieved a great deal. Hey, law school, through litigation, our earliest successes in housing and access to services, access to basic medical services, was as a direct result of lawsuits filed under the before we had the American Disabilities Act, handicap law. You can't discriminate on the basis of a disability or perceived disability. So we, doctors who were being thrown out of their offices, hospitals that were refusing to treat patients, the Social Security Administration not doing presumptive disability for someone on a respirator. All of those things we won with the lawyers. And those lawyers were paid for by mostly gay community groups. And not until 1984, 1985 did some of the big law firms step up with their pro bono commitments, and that has improved radically in the last couple of years. Now, while we're talking about the privates, I always go, but that's not the solution. That's just the safety net. This is, all these organizations shouldn't have to exist. We have governments and layers of bureaucracy and vast healthcare systems out there that should be responding to this, and to look at the foundations and community-based organizations and expect them to fix this is truly childish for a couple of reasons. The successful AIDS service organizations. I should say, the foundation I work for now distributed about $7 million to 200 local AIDS service organizations a year ago. I have 800 applications on my desk this year, but I don't have three times as much money. The community-based organizations rely on individual donors, on influential volunteers, and on huge and experienced professional staffs. Most of us are very well paid. When you look, those models that hold up in Chelsea, say the gay men's health crisis, or in West Hollywood with AIDS Project Los Angeles, those models don't make it. In another neighborhood where it's mostly single mothers, read those annual reports, the amount of volunteer time, the amount of clinical expertise, the amount of access to power and autonomy, and the sheer dollars to make it happen, those models don't apply for teenagers. They don't apply for poor people. They don't apply for recent immigrants. You got it? And Christine, you also said some of those agencies are beginning to struggle with diversifying those boards and all, but I still don't think, I don't think most people are getting what they need, even from those groups. I don't think you do either. I'm just saying those models of those community-based organizations we've built are strained to their max, and to expect them to continue to provide service at the level they have and influence policy at the level they had is simply not going to work. That's where I come to lack of institutional support. That is, we wouldn't rely on the CBOs and the foundations if our elected and appointed officials, our academic institutions and professional associations, our corporate and media interests were responding far more aggressively as they have to certain other social crises. Again, I go back to who's this happening to, and I think that's the critical difference. You have to look at the social and economic context of the AIDS epidemiology and admit in this country, as you heard before, that we routinely ration life and hope and services. We know all about drug treatment, about economic opportunity, about educational opportunity. We take no initiative, quite the contrary. We routinely, those are the first things we cut. It's survival of the richest in state and federal appropriations. And that's certainly not just AIDS. Your access to services and information is a direct function of class. The kind of information I can get about AIDS prevention and how early I get it and how well it's sanctioned that I get in Chelsea as an upper middle class white gay man totally plugged in, watching it all, what my doctor knows, what his experience has, my ability to go to a doctor, to pick up the phone and call the doctor with every little pimple on my body is a radically different treatment choice than someone who has to show up in the emergency room when they're finally short of breath because they can't afford to go to a doctor. Those affect morbidity and mortality rates. We choose who dies in this country routinely. Also, the community-based organizations, foundations, obviously lack direct policy-making authority. We can influence it. We can fund the shit out of the AIDS Action Council. We can fund future directions in AIDS research. Also, we can fund all the treatment activist groups. Those are all hugely useful things. But ultimately, I can't write the laws. I cannot make the NIH do all the research we said they should do. I cannot make state and city Medicaid funding streams create these kind of services without that. And that brings me to my last point, which is the lack of public and political will to do more. I really do come down to what Cloward and Piven taught me as an activist, that social change does not occur until the alternatives are unacceptable to most people. I think we all say that because AIDS is perceived in America as a problem of gay people, of poor people, of women, of people of color, that as many of those people can die as it takes, and we'll continue to make our funding decisions about what's politically expedient until things get much, much worse. I'm that pessimistic, and I don't think the science is being done, so I think we have 20 or 30 years here before we're going to see anything but a lot more people suffering much worse than we've seen today. Thanks.
You know, Roger ended early purposefully, so I wouldn't be able to tell him to shut up. This is a long thing, Roger. I'm very happy to introduce Mindy Full of Love and to say what I've never said to her, which is that the first time I heard her speak was in Amsterdam. And for me, that has been a critical speech in terms of reframing some of my own thoughts relative to the disease and the kind of mobilization that we have to enter into. So I'm pleased to welcome her here today with both the history she had there and with current new activities, and look forward to her presentation. Thank you.
By the end of my second year in medical school at Columbia University, I had developed a Pavlovian reflex, which was as soon as people dimmed the lights and turned on the slides, I went to sleep. So if any of you doze, I'll understand. I'm with you. I don't usually show slides, actually. I much prefer to talk. But I want to talk, since we're talking policy here, about some things that involve geography. And I want to show you some maps and pictures. And I think that being able to show them on slides is useful. So if you'll forgive me for showing slides, get started here. Now I'm supposed to do something later, I've forgotten. Oh, the FOR is forward. Yes. If you could move that one way or the other. I would like to present two propositions. The first is from Virchow, the great biologist, who said that if disease is an expression of individual life under unfavorable conditions, then epidemics must be indicative of mass disturbances of mass life. I think this is a critically important point. When we're thinking about epidemics, we're trying to understand why there was a shift from the baseline level of a disease to a much greater expression of the disease in a given society at a given time. Anthony Zui and his collaborator Antonio Cabral restated this proposition by saying high-risk situations place groups at particularly high risk of HIV infection. Almost everything you read in the American scientific literature about AIDS talks about individual risk-taking and not the situations in which individuals exist. And this is certainly a point that Nicolas was making before. Our science is ultimately very individualistic. I've just finished serving on a panel from the Institute of Medicine that has reviewed the NIH behavioral research portfolio over the first decade and some of this epidemic. And there's virtually no study of social groups and the relationship between social groups and the spread of disease. It's absolutely missing from the research portfolio. It's not just an impression, it's a fact. It's not there. But the understanding of risk situations is critically important. And as Zui and Cabral point out, these risk situations can be many, many kinds of social upheaval that place people at risk. They point out the importance of war, displacement because of economic reasons, for example, in Thailand, where people, especially young girls, go to the cities to become engaged in commercial sex work. And in this country, we think there are two critically important high-risk situations. The first is the displacement of gay men from their hometowns because of sexual discrimination. And the second is the destruction, the physical destruction of the inner cities. It's that that has been the particular focus of our work and what I want to talk about today. The second proposition is that in order to study high-risk situations, we must examine them along dimensions of person, place, and time. I think that it's clear person and time, we spend much less time thinking about place. And our work over the past some number of years, gets longer and longer with each passing year, has been to look at problems in places. And so what we have tried to understand is sort of the spatio-temporal nature of the AIDS epidemic. We are currently conducting a household study in central Harlem where we are interviewing a portion of the household residents. These are people who live in households. Some of them are not very fancy households. Some of them are, you know, the abandoned basement of a building, but they live in a building, so we're not talking to the homeless people. And we're in central Harlem. There are several Harlem neighborhoods, west, central, and east, and we're in central Harlem. The point of this study is to understand health and disease, to really try to get at why there is so much excess mortality and morbidity in central Harlem. As you may know, a man living in Central Harlem has less chance of reaching age 65 than does a resident of Bangladesh. And our study is directed at trying to understand that. So what is Central Harlem? This is a picture of what Central Harlem was. What is important about just this black and white picture is that every building is next to another building, and there are people walking along the streets. This is, if you will allow me to propose it, an intact unit in a densely populated urban setting. We think that this is the absolutely critical piece of social geography that's underlying much of the AIDS epidemic in inner city communities. This piece of intact urban dwelling space, the urban physical environment, has been destroyed. It's been destroyed by a number of processes, but it no longer exists. And Central Harlem is one of the most tragic places where you see this. In a two-decade period between 1970 and 1990, 30,000 housing units were destroyed in Central Harlem. This is what it looks like now. So instead of having that kind of intact space where building after building is a functional unit, providing stores, providing housing, providing meeting places, providing a safe backdrop for people to be on the streets, what you have instead is the creation of dead spaces, literally dead spaces. What does this do to the urban ecosystem? You have to think of this as something like a toxic waste dump in the middle of Yosemite Park. Have something as beautiful as Yosemite, and you take the worst chemical known to man and you dump it in the middle of Yosemite. It burns out the surrounding area and leaves it completely dysfunctional. It, in a sense, lifts it out of the functioning unit of the park and makes it a no-life zone. In the urban ecosystem, when you create this kind of toxic dead unit, you also create a no-life zone, in that the ordinary pace of urban life is completely disrupted by this kind of a dead space. Among other things, you have a disruption in the physical components of the urban space. So this building, an old building, was painted with lead, and lead has been unleashed into the environment. This building, when inhabited, had a way to control rats and other small vermin. That no longer exists. This building, when inhabited, had a way to cycle wastes. However wastes are cycled in an urban society, this building had that process when it was inhabited, and that no longer exists. And so the free dispersal of waste into the environment goes on once you create this kind of dead space. Now, what's important is to understand the connection between the physical level of the disruption of urban space and what that has done to people's real lives. What does it do to a community to lose a third of its housing units and to have left behind these hulking, ugly shells of buildings? One of the things it does is disrupt the social networks and the day-to-day life of people. Many of you are students, and all of you have been students, and therefore I may say with some assurance that all of you have been strapped for cash. And you know that one of the most important things when you're strapped for cash is that you have a friend. Because hopefully if you have a friend, if you're broke, your friend isn't broke. Or if you have two friends, you're pretty sure somebody's got cash. And there's always somebody who can buy a pizza and get you through. That is essentially how the American system of poverty has functioned, by tightly knit, geographically based networks that exchanged goods in a kind of rotating basis. A little bit like crop rotation. This is another picture of the same thing. This is the state building, a big, beautiful state office building, which is built right next to a very deteriorated building. What is important about this is to show the very patchy nature of most of the new building that has gone on. Harlem, Central Harlem, is a very large area, and you can imagine the effort it would take to replace 30,000 housing units. What it's meant is that people have built two here and three there and five there and a big state office building in another place. So there's been no reconstruction, re-knitting of the entire fabric of the community. The fabric of the community remains rent. The process of community destruction, which is set in place when you have created these dead, toxic zones of empty buildings, then is uninterrupted. that process is still in place. And patchwork rehabilitation cannot stop the momentum of the downhill process. This is patchwork rehabilitation. This is just to show the level of deterioration of some of these buildings, and this slide is particularly poignant. For those of you who know about the history of Harlem, Small's Paradise was one of the night spots in Harlem and one of the places that made it famous in its heyday. Now, this is a slide of some of our work in as part of our household study. Not only are we interviewing people in households, but we're also studying the neighborhoods. The dots represent grocery stores, laundromats, and playgrounds. Unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to make this slide in color, but what is important is to notice that there's a dead spot of all of these kinds of activities. These dead spots are very important. This particular dead spot is on 136th Street to 140th Street between 8th and Lenox, sort of this, the mid portion of the map, right around where it says 30, if you can see that, 30. What is important about that is that if you happen to live in that neighborhood, you have to walk a very long ways to get simple services like get your clothes washed or send your kid to a playground. You can't tell because, unfortunately, it's not in color, but there are very few playgrounds in Central Harlem. There are, in fact, four on this map. This is a map of safety. And the important thing about this, and again, I apologize that you can't see the color, is that the avenues where you'll see, like Lenox Avenue and Adam Clayton Powell, are the places where people really report that they feel safe. Where people don't feel safe are on the cross streets. The cross streets are almost all marked in red and yellow. Red are the dark lines on the cross streets, and yellow are the ones that you see faintly. Why is that? This is a really important thing about the structure of the Harlem community, which teaches us something about the intricate details of any community. On the avenues, you have large apartment buildings. The building that I showed you before was a corner building on an avenue. And those buildings are, first of all, they're very large. They're sort of many, many apartments. And they have storefronts in the bottom. So the avenues are wide and the buildings are big. On the side streets, you have much narrower streets, but you also have a completely different kind of architecture in Central Harlem, and that is brownstones, 3- and 4-story brownstones, very traditional New York City brownstones, some of which are architectural classics. But on these narrow, dark streets inhabited by these small brownstones, most of which have fallen into great disrepair, what you have is the complete takeover of those neighborhoods by crime, drugs, homelessness, building abandonment, so that the process of deterioration has been fast throughout Central Harlem, but fastest on the brownstone streets, and there has been least renovation on the brownstone streets. If you drive through Central Harlem, you see that Mayor Dinkins, as a great legacy of his administration, set into motion the construction of 6,000 housing units, a fifth of what Harlem needs. Most of those are on the avenues. Very few are on the brownstone streets. Now, just to shift gears a little bit from talking about a very particular community and a very detailed sense of a place, this place is important because it's an epicenter of the AIDS epidemic in New York City, and especially an epicenter for Black and Hispanic communities throughout the United States. But the other piece is, and that's been raised very much recently by the National Academy of Sciences panel, which said that AIDS was going to remain a ghettoized disease. The other piece is that true? Will AIDS stay in the ghetto? Okay, it's in the ghetto. Is that where it's going to stay? Are the suburbs really as safe as everybody would like to think they are? We've looked at that issue with some care in geographic studies of the New York region and also regions around other AIDS epicenters. This is a map from 1984, the AIDS case rate through 1984. And the darker it gets, the higher the number of AIDS cases. What you see as you look through time is the gradual extension of AIDS into the surrounding suburban communities. This is AIDS case rate through 1990. it was mentioned earlier that when people think of their fantasy of AIDS, they think of their fantasy of AIDS as a disease of gay white men. I think the parallel spatial fantasy is that AIDS is in New York, Miami, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. And there's no sense of the way in which it's spreading like a wine stain into the surrounding regions. Now, what's important about the structure of AIDS is that, she says I can keep going for 1 second. What's important about the structure of AIDS is that when we analyze the structure of AIDS, looking at the commuting patterns and the poverty patterns in this surrounding region, we see a very, very tight structure in which AIDS is tightly related to the pattern of commuting into New York City and out of New York City, and to the structure of poverty in this large region. There are millions and millions of people in this region. We also find that tuberculosis shares the same pattern. This map is almost identical to the last map of AIDS that I showed you. So when you look at tuberculosis as a disease, it's structured similarly in the New York metropolitan area. Now, these diseases are not structured identically in all areas, but in those areas with a hollowed out center city, in those areas where this Harlem process of burning down and destroying the inner city is very progressed, you see this structure of AIDS moving out, pumped out from the inner city. In fact, one might think of the center city as a pump for disease into the surrounding region. We can turn off the slides. My conclusion. Careful examination of the issues of person, place, and time that define high-risk situations will provide information critical to successful AIDS prevention. Now I can turn off the slides. Turn back on the lights. What is the point of this work? The point of this work is to, we are trying to do what Nicholas has called for, which is to try to understand not the individual level of risk, but the group level of risk, the social level of risk. And we are convinced that the social level of risk is highly related to the continued tolerance of high-risk situations, not only in our country, but in the world. And as long as we permit the destruction of the inner city to continue, with its echoing effects out to the surrounding areas, none of us will be safe. Thank you.
I think, Mindy, you can take a moment to get your breath and take a glass of water, but it seems only appropriate to maybe invite the panelists maybe to respond to what you've put out as a further contextualization of the epidemic and its spread. And I would invite each of you from your own perspectives and to speak to so what, you know, including you, Mindy. But you don't have to go first because you're resting. We can start at the end with Roger and go down this way.
Yeah, I'm going to find myself waiting for the revolution again, and I swore I was a Republican. no, it goes back. I think this it makes me very sad and frightened again. It always does when I sit down and contemplate this because I find that that archaeological explanation fascinating. Again, though, it's about, this isn't about AIDS, this is about who gets what. And the same lack of commitment to life in Central Harlem is the same thing that colors the lack of leadership across the board, and I'm not sure what it takes to change that, except lots of the ruling class to get sick, frankly.
Nicholas?
Yes, for a very long time, we've been saying that AIDS is another step in disempowerment. If you look at a very lay definition of AIDS, it's nothing but disempowerment at the cellular level. It's the inability of the body to harness enough power to mount an effective response to a challenge, right? I mean, we could say that that's the basic bottom line definition of AIDS. It is not then unrealistic to say and to expect that people who lack power at the political, the social, the economic, the architectural level will lack power at the biological level sooner or later, because the conditions that stress that organism and that community are operating on all levels. Unfortunately, what we saw in those slides, you can see in Holyoke, our Chelsea, which is very different from your Chelsea, in many places, and guess who lives there? Again, the pattern repeats itself state after state after state. And we have to address the issues systemically. If I might, I want to read something to you again from a man with AIDS, a Latino young man with AIDS in Boston, where we have some of the best and brightest teaching hospitals in the nation. He says, last winter I called the hospital because I was feeling very sick. I asked for a voucher to take a taxi to the hospital. The woman at the phone was not willing to give me a voucher and insisted that I had to get there by other means. I walked to the hospital. I stopped several times because I had difficulty walking and breathing. It took me 2 hours to get there. When I arrived, I was very ill. I had pneumonia. They took me to the emergency room, and I was in the hospital 9 days because they did not want to use the vouchers. It's about resources. It is about the priorities we have, whether we are committed to the life of every person in this country, or just, as Roger was saying, only to the lives of some people in this country.
Mindy, I'm going to ask you to respond before Christine, because I'd ultimately like her to reflect on this relative to a national plan. Mindy?
Well, I suppose I'm reminded of what my father, who was raised in the South and went to church a lot and often misquoted the Bible, used to say, which is that if you do it unto the least of these, you do it also unto me. I think the point I would like to make, in slight distinction to what Nicolas says, is that I don't believe that what ecology teaches us is that there are any islands of safety. I believe that what we learn from ecology is that if you unleash deadly things into the environment, everybody pays the price sooner or later. If you are wealthy, you may be safer for a longer period of time, but ultimately there's no escape. We have to treasure our environment, and and part of our environment are our human resources, and if we don't treasure them, we will all pay. So I think it's short-sighted. I think people are in denial and they're deluding themselves, but they are not safe.
Christine.
Fix it for us, Christine.
Yeah, right. This is where, at the point of the conversation where I get totally depressed. No, I am reminded in part of some Victorian treatises I have read about the debates regarding putting in sewer systems in Victorian England. And the tone of those who had to vote yes was, I honestly don't know why we have to do this. If the poor didn't like living by piles of shit, why don't they move to the country with the rest of us? It was a notion of choice that was deeply seated and had to be overcome. And those debates translate, regrettably, into some of the debates we're having today around our divisions in our society that keep people apart. I fear when some people hear your presentation, Mindy, where they will go with it and say, good, then we really ought to just wall those people up inside those ghettos so it doesn't seep out to the rest of us. I mean, I hear that isolationist view, and it's the same isolationist view we've heard throughout the epidemic of, why don't we find islands and ship everybody with AIDS to an island, or why don't we label them and isolate them here or there, some people don't hear what you're saying about community. And I ultimately think it is this notion of us as community that is at the heart of what it will take to solve this, that an understanding of our interconnectedness as human beings, as family, as neighborhood, as people together, is what we are trying to craft as we move toward a real national policy. And what I have as yet not gotten the insight on is what language works to get us there. I am talking with a lot of people about this, and I do know that many people don't start feeling warm and fuzzy about helping us out when they get yelled at, and that while yelling loudly helped draw attention to the epidemic early on,
we may be at a point where some other framework of dialogues and some other phraseologies about how we come together may be essential to bridging across all of those communities and neighborhoods. And finding the way to ask the questions right is, in fact, at the heart of the whole thing. And I'm going to keep working at it until we figure out a way to do it.
Well, see, I get those asshole questions from reporters all the time because I've been doing this, I think, longer than anybody else, AIDS specifically, yeah. Full-time longer, is how do you keep doing it? And what gets me up to fight every day is not, and I spend a lot of time talking to volunteers about this, is that if you are hanging your hopes on solving these problems to be effective professionally, you're a waste. Just go do routine casework or something. That the only value in this forum and the work we do, I think, is laying in place the models, building some of the political will, forming the dialectic, shaping the debate in such a way so that when circumstances are sufficiently intolerable for enough people, mm-hmm. maybe we'll look at that wisdom and have some of the models and some of the will yeah. in place. That all of these people will not have suffered and lived miserably and died in vain. But I got to tell you, and I agree, there is some balance. There's a number of languages we have to speak to a number of people, but I am deeply afraid of Larry Kramer's newest essays about this is evil. This is evil incarnate. We collude in genocide. We make conscious political decisions that have the effect of allowing people to die when it is within our power to change that. I think there's something deeply wrong with our society, and it's about coming to terms, just like the environment, just like race relations, like the empowerment of women, like the sexual revolution, that it's this notion of connectedness and making that make sense in real yeah. policy.
I want to open this up to the floor. I just want to comment, though, in closing on this particular section, that there are definitely a number of challenges, though, that come forth from the discussion that we just had. One is the limits and the possibilities of your position, Christine, and of the efforts of other people who identify themselves as part of the AIDS community in terms of addressing issues that are well beyond that arena, and the difficulties and, in fact, inherent problems with contextualizing them solely in the context of HIV, where you have issues now where people can in fact hold on to their housing because they are in fact positive or sick. And so I think that a policy issue that's raised by this whole discussion is the where of something that's so big that in fact surrounds and promotes the epidemic.
But if I can add to that, one of the value of the approach that we've just seen with mapping the urban problem, for example, is that it finds the commonality of those who got into this concerned about HIV with those who got into it because they were concerned about access to prenatal care and those who got into it because they were interested in access to better playgrounds, that there are some very diverse communities that share a common concern for that hunk of our life. And if we can use tools like this to bring them together around that common issue, they might even sound like they're fighting AIDS, but in fact they are, by what they do together to rebuild those communities.
Okay. I would appreciate if people would direct to whom they want to ask their question, unless it's one that you'd like anybody to respond to. In the back?
This is a question for Dr. Tozzo. Could you explain some more your statement that it's related to having commuting.
People, as you know, around all large urban centers, there are commuting fields. And people commute in to work, and people commute out from the urban area to work around. And the point is that you can map the field, can map quite precisely what that field is, who's moving in what direction. And so what we have studied is the connection between the proportion of people from a suburban county. The proportion of people commuting into the city, as well as commuting out of the city, and the relationship between that and the level of AIDS in that suburban county. And so the connection is that it's completely proportional around New York City and other cities that have this hollowed out core. It doesn't hold up in cities without this hollowed up core. So what we infer from that, our hypothesis is, that the hollowing out of the central city becomes the engine pumping disease out through this commuting field.
Well, if other people are thinking for another question, I have one that I'd like the panel to address. I felt that
Christine, and in the discussions, particularly that Christine and Roger and Nicolas had, that you raised different visions of possibilities and problems in terms of the evolution of community-based organizations, and I'd like to push you a little bit on that. And the extent to which you have a vision of a future where organizations that may have been gay-based to begin with can in fact extend their competencies into a range of different other communities that weren't gay-identified, and what may be problematic about that arena, the extent to which health-based service organizations, healthcare, community health centers and stuff, can move effectively into outreach and prevention and behavioral activities that typically have not necessarily been in their bailiwick, and what, how that functions both relative to the issues of there's a limit to how many resources we have and to how many communities in which we can situate specific AIDS identifying groups, but there's an absolute need to have a cultural competency and a trustworthiness in those that do in fact interface. So who would like to take this on first? Okay, Nicolas?
I would say one thing about the development of the CBOs, and also because much of their survival hinges on the response of the traditional foundations. We went from $0 to $5 million in private dollars in the first year. We never made the $100 million jump until about 85. We quadrupled that again by leveraging a number of the national foundations together, leveraging National Community AIDS Partnership through, you know, leveraging community trusts. And we have mobilized some of the richer professions like the entertainment industry that also have a public awareness. That I can see like another $100 million milked out of that rock, gross total for this country. That's it. That your community-based organizations can grow about this much farther. I don't think if GMHC, I don't think if you put us on the board, would be effective in doing prevention beyond the group they're talking to right now, providing direct services to. I think we have great models of spending down federal, you know, Ryan White money to Bailey House to GMHC. Those do not get distributed in other neighborhoods. I think we always go off the track when we look at the community-based organizations. That's your safety net. That's what's there. Those are useful tools in some neighborhoods. The money is skewed ridiculously as badly as the public money is, but that's not the solution. The solution is, do our hospitals, do our schools, do our community mental health providers, do our community drug treatment centers, do our offices of economic development actually deliver? We wouldn't be having this conversation if we were looking at the structure that exists.
Although you probably wouldn't say that, in fact, some of those mechanisms aren't necessary in terms of reaching out.
Oh God.
Okay, other comments.
Try to reform a few.
I think the fact that the issue of cultural competence is the origin of the organization for which I work, the Latino Health Institute, and I think that we paid a lot of attention to this particular issue. We have to be very careful not to place a burden on CBOs that the CBOs can't carry, and not to expect them to solve all the problems that should be addressed by other public entities. But also we have to be very careful, because in a country such as the United States, which has had a policy of assimilation of other nationalities, that has been the policy, and its metaphor is the melting pot. Remember that it's never been the thousand bean salad, it's been the melting pot, the metaphor in which we go, right? People come in here and you apply enough heat so that they lose their individuality and sort of melt into some amorphous mass. Being that the policy, we know that the public institutions have a tendency to enforce that policy and to be egregiously incompetent in serving other nationalities. So that although we can't expect too much from the CBOs and tax them beyond their limits, we also cannot rely on a public sector that is overwhelmingly European American, not only in composition, in ethnic composition, but in orientation. One thing that we fail to see here is we look at science and we say, well, science is culture neutral. No. Ask the Chinese if Western medicine is culture neutral, and they will say, you know, it's the ethno-medicine of European Americans. In the same way we think that Chinese medicine is an ethno-medicine of the Chinese people. And all our sciences are ethno-sciences, and we are intent on shoving them down the throat of different nationalities in this country, and that's what the public sector does. One solution for everybody, one size fits all, and that's just not true. So we need to develop parallel institutions that are sufficiently funded and supported by the public sector. Because if we again define AIDS and other problems as issues of lack of power, the solution is not more dependence on an outside power. The solution is creation of endogenous power and the endogenous institutions to deal with the problems.
Mindy or Christine, do you want to respond?
You asked for a vision or a direction, and I think in my sense of that vision, I would separate the truly privately funded and private CBO activity from the private organization that is funded through public resource or through pooled community resource from the fully public institution. And I think where we're going, and here I'll start factoring in health reform as a major part. I mean, one of the reasons we have the CBOs and the private resource we have is that we haven't had a non-discriminatory, non-cancelable, equitable way to pay for care.
Right.
Even if we had that way to pay for care, for some communities we would need the privately organized institutions to give the care in order to be ethnically responsive, community responsive, to fill gaps and so on. But that would free up the private resource not to be buying basic care, but to do extra innovative wraparound kinds of services. And that's the vision toward which I think we are headed, painfully slowly, and with some serious risks that in transition from here to there, communities will be lost, will be dropped into cracks, that we won't be sensitive enough to who all is at the margin and could get completely lost as we plunge forward. Hence the need to get more people to the table with their own voices so that we are hearing that problem as we move along through the process.
Will that include the undocumented?
Certainly in the community planning it will. I know it does not include them in the current national plan for the insurance scheme, but all of the public health systems in this country include the undocumented. They're there and they're being served, and they have to be a part of the process.
They also have to be paid for. Mindy?
We're just finishing up a study of the response of the healthcare system, in quotes, in Alameda County to the AIDS epidemic. We were interested in how did healthcare agencies come into the process. So we looked at a whole spectrum of agencies from very small CBOs to large government institutions. And it is extremely fascinating and complicated. The two earliest groups on the scene were one of the county groups, which got orders from CDC and upgraded its policies, and one of the gay organizations. So you see both this, you know, small, flexible, community-based organization and this very rigid government organization, the first people on the scene providing AIDS care. So there are two things that happen along this process. The first is that this fascinating thing that Christine was talking about of ownership, this sort of moving picture of ownership. With each passing year, more groups realized, oh my God, my group could be at risk for AIDS. So, you know, the Gray Panthers show up, and the women show up, and various different ethnic subgroups show up. Each at a different point, when it suddenly occurred to them, a sort of light bulb goes on, this is my problem too. What happened, though, was that as each new group came to the table, the same pie was divided up amongst more players. And so the amount of competition and became more and more ferocious, and the in-group fighting became very problematic. But the other thing was that there were so many pieces to this non-system that there was plenty of things that fell through the cracks. And I thought that those two were extraordinarily big problems which haven't been solved, in that although you had these different little CBOs and these different government organizations, there were massive gaps. There were no mental health services for people with AIDS in this whole picture. Mm-hmm. So there were glaring problems and a real inability of this non-system to sit down, think, plan, and make thoughtful arrangements for the future. So I actually think we're in a big mess.
Well, I would agree with that big mess, and I think we are also subdividing. People who take on crusades take on pieces of it. For example, I met earlier this week with the people who are in methadone maintenance treatment program, who run methadone maintenance treatment programs, and they would perceive themselves as real crusaders on behalf of substance abusers and really prepared to go out on limbs to defend that population. But talk to them about their responsibility to work with their clients around sexual risk for HIV and be honest that they have gay and lesbian people in methadone maintenance programs, and they went into a catatonic state in the audience on me. Because issues of sexual orientation and discrimination and isolation and lack of identity based on sexual orientation is totally discomforting to that substance abuse treatment world. They haven't wanted to talk about it, they don't want to deal with it, and so we have disconnects where we should have connections.
I'm going to stop you for a minute. I want to recognize a question there in the audience.
Given that I think people are generally have low tolerance for ambiguity, I was wondering what messages you, what strategies you think might be effective in dealing with people's low ambiguity for, I mean, low tolerance for ambiguity and these kind of conflicting messages which are out there.
Did you direct that to Nicholas? Is that?
Well, I guess we should be scheduled just because.
Okay.
I don't have that kind of money.
That's right. He said you next.
Yeah, you're next. So you get to think a while about your answer anyway. I don't have a ready answer to getting rid of the ambiguity because we are, in fact, in an area where the answer is a complex one. And one of the problems is that people have pushed for a yes, no, black, white, on, off, up, down, today, tomorrow kind of answer. And you don't get out of an epidemic of a socially supported, sexually transmissible disease associated with substance abuse in our society with 1, 2, 3 simple answers. I can tell you that sexual activity is absolutely safe. If you do it, if you do non-penetrating sexual activity, or if you do sexual activity only in the context of a mutually monogamous lifetime relationship entered to at virginity with a partner who never injects substances. I can tell you that, and that'll work for some people, but it doesn't work for others. I can tell you that in English, but if your language is Hmong, it doesn't do any good that I've told it to you that way. If you're figuring out how to pay your rent and how to not starve to death, telling you something about the esoteric differences in low-risk sexual activities is irrelevant to you. And that is the problem with this kind of an epidemic, that for a society looking for 5-second news clip, one-time answers, there is no way from here to there.
I'd like to take a stab at this because we are pouring not enough funds, but a certainly big amount of them into drug research, for example. And I think, how many studies have we done on ACT? Actually, we should bury the damn thing. It's been so studied. What happens here is that if we look at the history of medical interventions, and there's a professor right here at New England Research Institute, Dr. John McKinley, has graphed this. The payback you get from even very effective medical interventions, tertiary interventions, vaccines, treatment, is very little. When you compare it to upstream interventions, preventive interventions, health promotion interventions, and we have been spending scant resources on the back end of this situation. Our former Commissioner of Public Health in the city of Boston used to say that what we do here is we have a bunch of people jumping off a cliff, and we've developed this wonderful system at the bottom to fix them up once they've fallen, but it hasn't occurred to us to get to the top and either build a wall or start telling people, excuse me, if you keep going that way, you'll fall off. I mean, we don't think of that. We prefer to fix them up when they fall. that's what we've been doing basically, funding-wise, and funding very often drives the policies and the practices of many organizations. So we have to make a conscious decision and put the resources at the front end. We don't know how to cure AIDS. We probably won't know for a very long time. We do know how to prevent the spread of HIV. But yet we are not putting our money where the interventions can be most effective.
Over here.
A number of things, trying to figure out how to take those findings and turn them into a useful part of national policy. You may know that several agencies, for syringe exchange programs or needle exchange programs to be effective at a community level, they have to involve several agencies. The ones I know of, at least, that have been successful, the health agency, the mental health agency, the drug abuse agency, and the police agencies of the community really have to be in some kind of partnership or agreement for them to be widely effective. And therefore, my perception for a national policy on syringe exchange or needle exchange to be effective, the national equivalents, the Drug Policy Office, the Department of Justice, HHS, really all need to be together to translate those findings into a useful national policy. Some of those offices haven't even thought about this in the past or have thought about it in a pretty rigid way. So we have discussions going across all of those agencies, sharing data, looking at how to translate them and what's happening. And meanwhile, a conversation with the mayors of cities and with others, encouraging them, if they've got that kind of local concurrence that would support their going ahead, although right now all we can use because of congressional direction is our federal money for evaluation purposes until we get a broader declaration of policy. So it's moving, but it's moving slowly.
Roger, go ahead, briefly.
I've read the studies, Christine, and everything you're saying is true, but I mean, the cynic in me steps back and says, do you actually think we're going to get enough clean needles in the junkies' hands before the epidemiology outpaces this generation too? No. And it's like, maybe we'll learn something from those studies, maybe this will shake out, maybe this will shake out a serious war on drugs in this country as opposed to a war on the other hemisphere.
Well, it's one of the reasons that the new prevention money in the FY95 budget is in drug treatment and not in other forms of prevention, which has been hard for some people to accept. Because I agree with you, we've got to go into a much more aggressive
program.
But
again, even that amount of money, Christine, was how much can we get out of Congress, not how much will it cost to effectively attack this problem. I'm going to go back. This goes through prevention and policy changes. When we looked at, in 1985, we looked at the entire mental health system of New York City, all the hospital psychiatry and social work departments, every drug treatment center, all the psychiatric group residences, because we had all these high-risk people there, we had all these incredibly well-trained professionals working there, and we were going, why are they not doing routine prevention work with them? Why are they not providing direct access for the clinical problems they have? It's appropriate and all these people are perfectly capable. We measured objective knowledge about AIDS across discipline, across setting, and it was extraordinarily high, as you can imagine. Nurses, social workers, doctors knew the virology, knew the science as much as anyone knew it, backwards and forwards. So then we did this at Rockefeller and Sloan Kettering, went to the behavioral scientists and said, can you tease out the attitudes and beliefs that prevent otherwise conscientious, decent, well-trained people from doing what they should do? And I'll say them very quickly, they were uniform across every group. And then we went and started talking to the prevention people and realized they were dealing with the same barriers. So whether it's the President of the United States worrying about how much political risk he'll take to put some teeth into these kind of interventions, or whether it's us trying to deal with the ambiguity of any sexual decision in our life, there's four things cooking for every human being. One is confrontation with mortality. That is, in the Freudian model, bad things happen when you think or do bad things. Well, bad things happen when you do this. And the other was realistic and unrealistic fears of contagion. That is, what is appropriate risk. Are my healthcare workers going crazy? Do they have an appropriate occupational risk, or are they merely confused about sexual detail? The most telling, the most frequent, was feelings of helplessness and hopelessness, that I can't make a difference, whether it's in my own sex life or whether it's in my hospital psychiatry department, that I'm doing the best I can with what I've got. My life is complicated. It's all I can do to get laid, much less negotiate getting laid. And similar to the chief of service, I've got all these other problems. I'm overworked, I'm underpaid, I have all these other problems. And our least frequent barriers are what we call the social barriers to information and services, class, race, gender, homophobia, that sort of thing. That is that people have not come to terms of the risk to them personally. They're in denial, classic psychological denial. The president is at risk. We have all done.
Hurry up, Roger.
My point is, we're all at risk for AIDS, and we're all invested in denying why we are, whether that's political or personal, that much of the work has to be talking about how AIDS affects me and taking action as opposed to why it doesn't affect us.
It is kind of like who's on first. I mean, the question of leadership in the context of something that is as broad-based as what Mindy has so clearly surfaced is challenging. I saw a question over here. Would anybody like to respond? The comments of it wasn't entirely her, but essentially the challenge that while there were good points made about what needs to be done here, they just further pointed out the lack and the need for a national plan.
I agree, and that's what we're in the middle of doing. The elements of the plan have been outlined actually for a decade. They include action in research, action in services, and action in prevention. And to pull them off, we need what I described earlier as action to make it a national effort, not just an effort of any one element. The basic goals have been outlined in about 12 publications, some of them public, some of them private. Those are, my office has lifted those out of those documents. They're in circulation now for comment among a range of people. They will be available to all agencies of the federal government and then to other people to write very specific action plans within a very short time. We are definitely headed toward having that document. But I think all the documents in the world, and I can tell you, I can find you 15 high-class, over-educated federal plan writers to this minute who would produce you a plan if I told them to,
goodness,
will not mean diddle squat unless we get over the denial. And that's why I've put at least as much of my effort in these first 9 months in figuring out how to deal with the denial communication pieces as I have in producing pieces of paper. It has led to some criticism of me by a number of groups. That was a value judgment I made of where we needed to go with our efforts there.
If you'll excuse me, but although I do not dispute the question of denial, a lot of what passes for denial is actually being preoccupied with something else and having a worry hierarchy that cannot contemplate things that happen in the future. People have a worry budget, and if you are overexpended in your worry budget, you can't worry about AIDS or anything else that comes along. You know, there are things that take up your worry budget and that's it. What we need to do is we need to go beyond categorical funding and categorical solutions. AIDS has struck us in the face and told us the disease-based solutions do not work. Population-based solutions work. We have to stop thinking of people as people with AIDS or people with this or asset. Friend of mine says who works for DPH, I deal in bones only, preferably if they're female and old. We have to stop looking at whole people. And until we can do that, we're not going to solve anything. It's not that people want to deny that they're at risk for AIDS. Some people may, but most people are too busy dealing with other issues in their lives to start paying attention to things that may or may not happen in the future. We have to address people where they are with the needs that they have now. That is effective AIDS prevention. That is effective AIDS care, to address people where they are with the needs they have now.
I'd like to recognize up here. I'm going to ask everybody, questioners and speakers, to be very brief because we are now over time, but since there's a little interest, I want to continue.
Director, when is the date you have set forth to receive the national information about? Because as we know, worldwide, the United States and Supreme Court, you are our voice. You have been appointed to say today, tomorrow, the next day.
The document called an action agenda will be ready within, I would say, a month to a month and a half, although it's making it final depends on the first meeting date of our new National Advisory Board, and I don't have a date for that yet. But I see any national plan we write as a rolling document, not a fixed thing that we'll write sometime in 1994 and then it'll just stand there till the epidemic ends, but rather a thing we write this year that we'll revise within 6 or 9 months and revise again and revise again. And I'm really committed to that kind of rolling agenda rather than big, fat volume, thick plans that try to put everything in them at the front end, because I think they waste too much planning time and end up being an excuse for action. But you'll see a first cut of it over this later part of this spring.
Okay,
it'll be available.
I see three hands. This woman here, this gentleman, and this woman down here, and then we're going to stop. Please, quickly. Yes, go ahead.
This is for Mindy from the left. First, a comment, which is, I think that's a very powerful presentation. And in all the years I've been a public health, I've never seen a presentation like that. And I think that it takes the focus away from specific groups and it just gives the viewer an entirely different orientation about the spread of HIV/AIDS. And I think that it could be used very usefully. I mean, we write that kind of thing in ranks, you know, the generation of the inner city, blah, 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 but you know, I've never seen it really quite in this way. Okay. So my question is, could be published in an American engine?
Go on.
There are some of the, a great deal of the medical geography is work that on which I've been a collaborator, but the real head of the team is Dr. Roderick Wallace and his wife Deborah Wallace, and they've published in a wide range of journals, but social science and medicine is where we've published a great deal of this stuff. So a great deal of the medical geography is there. Our work on Harlem hasn't come out yet. We're still doing the field work, so that'll be out, God willing, and the creek don't rise, in the future. And
but what's the specific date?
Go ahead, Mindy.
It's not late spring. And my own work is dispersed here and there, various minor journals.
Yes.
I heard Mr. Kamara a lot about so-called cultural competence in general, no science and description, of the service delivery systems, the measures or any other indices of so-called cultural competence. Could you give me some examples of what that means in practice too? How do you address it in your own Latino community, where European Latinos, for example, do not address basic things like the Africanized Latino population,
for prejudice and institutional racism that is picked up by the white Latino, usually provider population, against the black Latino population.
Those are excellent questions. The first one, yes, cultural competence is not a fuzzy thing. Cultural competence is a very clearly defined, and we can share with you lists of knowledge, attitudes, and skills, things.
Yes,
if you give me the chance to do so, I will. The first thing is that a culturally competent service is one that identifies, respects, and incorporates the core values of the service population in the design, the implementation, and the evaluation of the service. That's the first thing.
And that's all you can do to describe it right now, because I appreciate the importance of this question, but why don't you get to the second piece and then maybe make yourself available. It's a very important issue because people give lip service
but
to
it. But it is important that it's not fuzzy.
It's not fuzzy. It usually implies a provision of service also from people who share cultural values and at the very least language and some other kind of commonality with the people who are receiving the service. But to the second part of your question, in every community there are class distinctions, racial distinctions, and particularly if you talk about the Latino community, where we have European Latinos, we have Asian Latinos, we have Native American Latinos, and we have African Latinos. Of course, there are all the possibilities of different types of discrimination. And it does happen that the immigrant communities or the US-based Latinos tend to replicate systems of oppression that are typical of our countries of origin, where European Latinos control in their countries of origin, they will tend to replicate those patterns here, if nothing else because they have had access to more education and more resources. What we attempt to do here, at least in the institution where I work, is to make sure that the service population is reflected in the providers, in the provider population, to the best of our ability. And to be aware that mere ethnic congruence does not guarantee cultural competence, that issues of economic and social standing and of race are paramount in determining a cultural competence. Those issues must be taken into account. It's not merely, I'm from here, I'm from the same place, therefore I'm culturally competent. In fact, one of the things that impedes cultural competence most of the time is professionalization. People who have been professionalized out of their communities.
Okay, last question.
I want to echo what Helen said about Dr. Fola's presentation and a way of making it so concrete, you know, the building and streets and services and communities, the idea that groups are at risk and it's related to geography, which has so many economic factors. But I also fear the coercive use of public health powers and the comment that was made about, you know, wanting to wall off. And I think you did part of the work of building a case against that by showing the spread of the Weinstein, that it isn't going to be confined to those communities. But I think we also need to be doing work of filling in the sort of the causation. Why does that bombed out building cause drug abuse, which causes the HIV infection? You know, what are the various steps in the middle?
Well, one of the things that our research group and others have been campaigning for is research funds. And, you know, our grants are routinely turned down. There is no funding money for this kind of research. And so one of the things that we have passionately argued is that we need money to answer those questions, and we don't have it, and it's not out there, and people aren't interested. So it's been a big problem just introducing the concept. You're saying it's new, and you haven't seen it before, and that's true. Nobody's doing this kind of work. We think it's a vital component of understanding the AIDS epidemic. AIDS has a spatial dimension, and for I really focused in my presentation on the spatial dimension of the AIDS epidemic for blacks and Latins, but the spatial dimension for the gay community is just as important and just as powerful. And the spatial dimension all around the world is extraordinarily important. So you can chart the kinds of social upheavals that are spreading the virus in every place where you have an epicenter of the virus. So I think it's a missing piece of our research, and I can only say that I am advocating it everywhere I go. Give us money to study this spatial dimension of the AIDS epidemic, and I hope it'll happen.
I want to thank our panelists and our audience, and also to comment that while I would hope in some respects that the challenge in front of us was ridding the denial, I think the real challenge is ridding the dismissiveness of the people that we're talking about, and that the lack of caring that Roger pointed out, the lack of willingness to care about those who most clearly are currently affected by this disease, runs as a river through all of our decisions that are being made. Thank you very much for your attendance, and thank you very much, panel.